I'd like now to welcome Stella Reed. She's Director of Community Outreach at the Southwest Care Center, and Fernando Casados, who is Community Outreach Coordinator there, and Arthur Lopez, who is a sculpture artist. And all of them have been working on and are going to tell us about Es Mejor Saber, La Exposición de Arte. It's an art exhibition that opens this Friday, the 28th of September at El Museo Cultural. At 5 o'clock, welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Thank you for having us.
So, Fernando, you came up with the whole Es Mejor Saber, It's Better to Know, concept and campaign. What's it all about?
Mm-hmm. Well, we saw an increase of HIV infection among Hispanics and Latinos in northern New Mexico just a few years ago, and we realized that many of them were those who had not been tested and were showing up with a late diagnosis of HIV infection or AIDS. So we felt there was a need to try to get into the population, educate them, and let them know how important it is to get tested early, and if they are positive, to receive treatment that we provide there at Southwest Care Center.
Now, Southwest Care Center is AIDS and HIV and hepatitis C. What is it about?
Yeah, we've just recently expanded to providing testing and services for hepatitis C as well. For over 16 years, we've been a center of excellence in HIV and AIDS care, and we've been providing the rapid test on a free and anonymous basis at our clinic on Monday nights. We've recently expanded our outreach department so that we're also out in the community in a few select places doing the rapid anonymous HIV testing. And our research department at Southwest Care Center began working with people with hepatitis C, and it became a much more important issue, and we became aware that the incidence of hepatitis C is pretty critical in northern New Mexico in particular. And so we've just expanded our services to include testing and treatment as well as research on the hepatitis C virus.
And so is the Es Mejor Saber campaign also takes into account hepatitis C?
Oh, yeah, sure, it does. It's better to know your status as far as HIV is concerned, hepatitis C, and any other health issue.
Now, why is it that this population is so vulnerable?
I don't know. I think there's several reasons. I think maybe one of them is that, and being Latino myself, that we tend not to speak of some of these issues for whatever reason. We're just uncomfortable with it. And so if we don't talk about it and we don't necessarily get educated about it, we don't do what is necessary or what we should be doing. And that's getting tested for one thing.
And so in the campaign that you're doing, that's something that you have to break through.
Exactly. We realized we had to let individuals know that it is good to get tested and let them know in a way that they could actually connect with and respond to. So Es Mejor Saber really approached it as a kind of a very graphic, very colorful, very engaging type of campaign. And it was received very well. You know, the image itself is a heart, and it's really a tattoo of a heart.
Right.
Right. And it has wings, and it has the statement Es Mejor Saber on a banner floating in front of the heart. And that has really resonated with Hispanos and with really everyone in northern New Mexico.
Right.
They seem they appreciate it, they like it, and it kind of engages them, and then the conversation goes forward from there.
It's Better to Know kind of suggests that a lot of us are in denial, and the concept of denial is something that so many people are familiar with.
Oh, sure, sure. And it's not just among Latinos. I mean, a lot of people are just in denial for whatever reason. So it is important to know these things.
Now, this image that you were talking about, the kind of tattoo-like image, has been painted as a mural.
Right, right. We thought it would be a great idea to have it reproduced as a large mural in town, you know, not for a mural. And so we engaged one of our local muralists, John Santos, who has done, you know, who's known for his murals. He said that he would do that. So a couple of years ago, we were allowed to paint the mural at the old Cloudcliff Bakery, and we had an event around that. It actually occurred on National Latino AIDS Awareness Day. So John and his fellow graffiti artists took the afternoon and painted the Asmejo Saber image. We had some of the Arambe movement hip-hop dancers there. And it was a nice event.
So now this Friday at El Museo is the Exposición de Arte, the art exhibition of Es Mejor Saber, and you, Arthur, have been on the planning committee for that and are also one of the artists in it. Tell us how that whole process has come together.
Well, you know, we were approached, I was approached back in, you know, several months ago, so the planning has been going on for at least probably 6 months in advance, and I got together with this organization because I felt it was a great cause for one thing, but also just exciting to be part of something bigger than yourself, for one. The organization and the artists and the planning committee all came together, and, you know, we'd sit down and decided what we were going to do with the organization, what we wanted to achieve, what type of artists we wanted to invite.
And it's very much of a kind of New Mexican Hispanic art look, the pieces that are in this show.
Exactly.
It's quite beautiful.
Well, trying to get together, because it is focused on the Latino community, I think getting together with a lot of the Latino artists and the New Mexican traditional art aspect, both contemporary and traditional, the artists can also relate to the cause, the Es Mejor Saber. And a lot of it, like with the image, you know, the artists were asked to create a piece that reflected the image as well as the slogan, Es Mejor Saber. And within the Latin and Hispanic community, a heart is very, you know, prominent in their homes, whether it's a sacred heart or just the beating heart of one's, you know, soul. And so it really all tied together. So a lot of the artists, when they came together and they found out what it was about and they gave them the opportunity to create something unique and special for this cause, a lot of them all jumped on board. And, you know, unfortunately, because this is the first year, there were a lot more artists that wanted to participate that just weren't able to do it at the time, but they're excited for next year's also. So it's,
this will be an ongoing thing.
Yeah, that's the hopes of it.
We hope so, yeah.
Now, you have a piece which has hummingbird imagery. What's that about?
The title of my piece, it's a sculpture. It's a wood sculpture. It's a wood carving that's then painted. I titled it Esperanza de la Vida, which is a hope of life or a hope of a new life. And again, it has the slogan Es Mejor Saber running around an awareness ribbon around the heart. The heart, of course, again, it's fashioned after a traditional sacred heart, but blooming out of it instead of flames are lilies, and they're kind of like fire lilies or you know, the red star lilies. And so they tie into the flames. And the hummingbird is kind of it's almost a reference to kind of, you know, how quick the taking of the blood would be, the process, the Es Mejor Saber. It's quick, it's fast, it's easy. Hummingbirds fly around. You know, they're needles, they're poking into the flower. It's quick, it's done, and they're on their way. And they're beautiful. They're here for you know, the summer around Santa Fe now. And then they're gone, you know. And it's just kind of that reference of the whole idea of the show and the piece and, you know, and the beauty of it also,
yeah.
You know, because it's HIV, hepatitis, everything is, it's not secluded to one person. You know, anyone can be affected by it. It's not any one status, anyone, you know, nationality, any, you know, it's out there for everyone, so.
Now, this campaign has gone well, and you've had success in really getting people tested who might not otherwise have done so.
Mm-hmm.
And when people get tested, do you find that there are a lot of positives?
Well, you know, ever since the campaign started, we did find that those that were positive were coming from the Hispanic community, primarily younger Latino men, there was an increase, which we really hadn't seen that type of increase, mm-hmm. had we, Stella?
No.
Yeah. And so these people now, first of all, they can get treatment earlier than they otherwise would have.
That's right.
And they could also know not to know how not to infect others.
Exactly. You get education. When we tested Southwest Care Center, and I'm glad that Arthur mentioned this, the fact about the hummingbird drawing blood very quickly, and that's what we do at Southwest Care Center. It's a rapid test, so it's a very simple and very quick needle stick on the finger.
Uh-huh.
And it takes 10 minutes, literally 10 minutes to get your result.
Part of that whole process is also an emotional process of supporting the person at that time.
Exactly. So there's a whole period while you're waiting, you know, for the result, and even after, we can engage with the individual and talk about risk factors, talk about how you would reduce your risk or things just as simple as how is HIV transmitted. And so it's not just testing and getting a result, but it's actually counseling and developing risk reduction plans if you need me.
Do you think what's the highest source of transmission among these people now? Is it sexual or?
It's sexual, yeah. Unprotected sex is usually the highest mode of transmission. And, of course, with hepatitis C, it's needle sharing.
Right. So, Es Mejor Saber, La Exposición de Arte, It's Better to Know, the art exhibition is happening this Friday, the 28th of September, at El Museo Cultural in the Rail Yard here in Santa Fe. It's from 5 to 7:30. Now, are the pieces for sale? Is this a fundraiser for the Southwest Care Center?
Yeah, they are. Mm-hmm. A portion of the proceeds are going to go back to the Prevention and Outreach Department at Southwest Care Center. So it'll go back into the campaign.
Very
basically.
Nice.
Yeah.
And you've got a lot of artists, and you also have Jimmy Santiago Baca, who's going to be there. What's he going to be doing? Reading
He's going to be reading poetry, most likely. Mm-hmm. And he'll be starting at 6 that evening. Nacho Mendez will be there playing music starting at around 5. So when the doors open, they'll be greeted with Nacho playing, and there'll also be a cash bar. There'll be hors d'oeuvres, so we're going to make it festive.
A wonderful event, and it goes on through the 14th of October, and then on the 15th, is
National Latino AIDS Awareness Day. So we're kind of hoping to wrap up the entire event with a push towards getting the Hispanic Latino population in to test at Southwest Care Center on that Monday night, the 15th. Again, it's free, it's rapid, results in 10 minutes, and it's anonymous.
And that's at the Southwest Care Center?
Yep.
Where's that?
It's 649 Harkle Road.
Not far from the hospital. Mm-hmm. What should people know that they might not know, people listening to this show right now, about preventing HIV and about preventing hepatitis C?
Well, first of all, I would say if you think that you're at risk, I'm going to list a couple of risk factors for both, but if you think you're at risk, please call to make an appointment to get tested. Like I said, it's free, anonymous, every Monday night. And the toll-free number is 888-320-8200. And just once you start hearing the recorded voice, hit the zero for the operator and tell her when you'd like to come, and you are.
And the local number is 989-8200. So what are the risk factors that you were talking about?
For HIV, it would be unprotected sex. Okay, it would also be sharing intravenous drug-using needles, anything, if you were shooting up drugs, if you were using steroids, anything of that type.
Unprotected meaning no condoms.
No condom. Use your rubbers, people. That's my prevention message. And then for hepatitis C risk factors, this is an interesting one. People who were born in the baby boomer generation, we're finding it more at risk because so many years ago, hepatitis C didn't even have a name. They didn't know what it was. They were calling it non-A, non-B hepatitis. So even if you yourself weren't engaging in risky behaviors back then, hepatitis C is spread through blood, and it's very easily transmissible. So you may have been living in a communal situation with a roommate, with a partner, whatever, at that time, who may have had hep C, didn't know it, you didn't know it, you shared a razor, you shared toothbrush, any kind of any type of item that might have blood on it.
Right.
Okay, so that would be one risk factor, just simply being born between 1945 and 65. So we will provide you with a free test for that. The other would be sharing, same with HIV, sharing shooting equipment, whether it's the needles or any of the other equipment that would be used when you're shooting up drugs. If you're sharing those, not a good idea. Also, snorting equipment. If you'd ever used cocaine or snorted any type of drug and shared the straw, shared the rolled up dollar bill, that's another way that can be transmitted. Really? Mm-hmm. Blood transfusions before 1992, coming in contact with anybody's blood through accident, or you know, helping somebody if they had a bloody nose or that type of thing.
All those things, and people are coming in with Hep C that they got through things like that.
Not so much. There have been a few instances where we have received people with Hep C that have gotten it through sharing snorting equipment. Some that were born in that birth cohort, but it's mostly intravenous drug use and sharing the equipment. And it's very, again, I'm just going to say it's very easily transmissible through the blood. So,
the Southwest Care Center is at southwestcare.org. Stella Reed, Fernando Casados, and Arthur Lopez, thank you so much for being with us, and we will see you at La Exposición de Arte Es Mejor Saber this Friday, September 28th at El Museo Cultural. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome back to the program Charlie O'Leary. He's Executive Director of the Santa Fe Conservation Trust, and Jan Willem Janssens, who's an ecological planner. He's the head of Ecotone. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Charlotte.
So the theme for today is trails, and there are a lot of trails that probably many of our listeners go walking or hiking or biking on, and multiple use is one of the very important questions that people have about trails. There is a trails conference coming up, and there's also a mountain bike conference coming up, and are mountain biking and horseback riding and hiking and walking and dog walking, are they all compatible on the same trails, or do we need different trails?
I would say that they're compatible on all trails. It's an issue that we've been talking about here in Santa Fe for quite a few years now, but I guess a little bit more intensely over the last year as we've been working on the La Tierra open space area up in the northwest quadrant, and as we're having the International Mountain Bike Association, they're having their World Summit here in October. They're, of course, mountain bikers, and so we've been talking a lot about different trail use. But I think, generally speaking, we're looking to have multiple trail users on the same trail.
Well, I think not everybody will agree with you, Charlie. So, and
like you, perhaps?
Yeah, that's right, Mary Charlotte. I would say I love mountain biking if I can and have the moment to do it. And then when I'm thundering down a trail, it is hard to just break hard enough for that pedestrian. But when I'm this walker and I hear this mountain bike click-clacking down a hill, I would wish that he wasn't there or she. So I think I agree with you, Charlie, that we would maybe want to accommodate everybody. But honestly, also for if I'm also coming from the point of view of maintaining and designing trails, that actually the width and erosion control issues and the line of sight on a bike trail, or especially also on a horseback trail, is quite different in some corners here of what a pedestrian trail should be.
Let me add a little asterisk to my answer there, and I agree as well. Although I think that to begin with, there needs to be more communication between users and you said accommodation. I definitely think that during busier times of the week, when there's multiple types of users out on the trail, we have to use the trails differently and be respectful that there's other users out there. And I think mountain biking is a great example. But I don't think we're quite at the point where we can have separate trails for different users. I mean, it would be nice, and I know, again, mountain biking is a good example where there's different features that are enjoyed. Banked curves and turns is one example enjoyed by mountain bikers that, you know, don't necessarily work for other users. It'd be nice to be able to have more of those features on trails that are specific for mountain bikes. So I think I actually think it's a little bit of both, that we need to respect the trails that we currently have. We need to get volunteers out to help work on those trails. I think it's actually a great way to get different users to interact together and get to know one another. But I agree with your answer as well. There are some of the uses are become so specific that we do have to look at how the trails are designed, how they're maintained, what are the different uses that they do play a role.
Yeah.
The International Mountain Biking Association is having its summit, pun intended, I'm sure, here in Santa Fe, October 10th through 13th. And one of the things that they've been quite active in is promoting trail etiquette for mountain bikers, both so that there are fewer conflicts and so that they don't get kicked off of the trails altogether, which has been a real danger. I mean, there have been, over the last 20 years or more that since mountain biking has become very popular, a lot of trail association people who are in charge of the trails have actually said this is not for mountain bikers at all, and they've been trying to fight that by having really proper etiquette. What is that etiquette? Is there a right of way? Are there any rules that people abide by?
Yes, there are rules, and mountain bikers are supposed to yield to equestrians. They're supposed to yield to hikers, and
so they're supposed to yield to everyone.
Yeah, they actually
wildlife,
are supposed to.
Wildlife. Mm-hmm. Everything else.
Yep. Come to a stop and pull over on the trail. Now, realistically, I think what happens quite regularly is hikers, it's easy for them to pull over and let the mountain bikers ride by. I think one interesting thing about mountain bikers, in my experience has been in talking with other trail users, and I'm a big mountain biker myself, is that the bikes are so quiet that it's very easy to sort of sneak up on a hiker, or if somebody's wearing an iPod while they're out on the trail, they can't hear a mountain bike approach, and it startles them, and people get really startled. They get scared. All of a sudden, there's maybe three or four people on their back right behind them, and it can be startling. So one of the things that we've tried to do through a group called the Trails Alliance of Santa Fe is actually hand out bells to mountain bikers and encourage them to use their bells and let people know well in advance that they're coming.
Right.
And so you either do that by ringing the bell, or you call out good morning or hello. And I think that resolves, in my experience, that resolves the majority of the problems. As long as other trail users know that mountain bikers are coming, that can help a lot.
When you talked about people listening to music on the trails, that seems like a really bad idea.
It's kind of funny because when I walk, I often enjoy just the silence.
Exactly.
But I can understand.
Or
I
the
love
non-silence.
Music too.
I mean, yeah, the sound of the leaves and the squirrels.
Absolutely. The natural sounds. Because that's part of the whole landscape experience, together with the view and the colors and the light. But yeah, I mean, I can see the combination of listening to some favorite music and that landscape, and it's not always the wisest thing in terms of being a social user of the trail and being aware of other people that use the trail. Absolutely.
Now, what is the impact of mountain biking on trails? Does it cause problems with the trails, erosion, things like that?
The impact of mountain biking on trails, I think, is pretty light. But what you have to think about is what's the condition of the trail when people are riding it. So typically you won't have people out riding in the springtime when the trails are muddy and most vulnerable to being damaged. You can also get some erosion and some problems with people skidding around turns. So that can be a problem. But typically if you look at you know, the rubber surface of a tire on a hard surface, it's not doing a lot of damage.
Yeah, I think from my experience, the turns and curves are the most somewhat problematic because of the width of the trail and the turn of a turn, the angle, bikers can only take a very specific part of that trail. And there you get a lot of concentration of tire track, or also because they have to brake there, and so that leads to a berm on the outsloped part of the trail. So you get a cupped trail that then collects water and erodes more rapidly in those turns, and so they require then more maintenance over time.
You, Jan Willem, are very much involved with and have a very deep understanding of erosion and landscapes and human impact on landscapes, and you've actually been involved with putting out a brochure, or a, not a brochure, a book, a guide called Caring for Good Trails, which is for volunteers who are doing trail maintenance here in the Southwest, not just even in New Mexico. And this is an interesting book because it basically shows you through photographs and text what the problems are and how to solve them. Tell us about it.
Yeah. When I worked with Earthworks Institute in the last 10 years, I saw a need, maybe already about 10 years ago, for more community education and landowner and resident education about the use and stewardship of the outdoors. And so in collaboration with different partners, Earthworks developed educational booklets. We have developed booklets on erosion control, on stream restoration, on septic waste management, and then several years ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, based on experiences of trail building in the 1990s that I had here, where I saw a lot of different trails and trail problems, I remember that it might be good to have actually a specific trail booklet for the type of trails that we have here, like the Dale Ball trails, or the trails in La Tierra, or the trails in the Galisteo Basin Preserve, or on Glorieta Mesa, and that there actually isn't a booklet like that. That because the booklets that are out there are either for mountain bikes that are actually slightly different, in my view, or for high mountain trails, a Forest Service book that is out that is very good. But just this niche of the narrow 12 to 18 foot trails in semi-rocky or sometimes sandy terrain between pinyons and junipers going up and down, there's nothing for that. And especially not for, and most booklets focus on design. And but for to have a pocket guide for people who go out and participate in workshops or that you can use in workshops as a training guide, that was not there.
Yeah.
So working with the Santa Fe Conservation Trust and people at Santa Fe County, we came up with a concept. And with some grant monies, I wrote the first draft that was tested at the Santa Fe Conservation Trust several years ago and through the Trails Alliance. And then we found some funding from with support from REI to complete the trails booklet about a year ago. And with Charlie's help, we eventually got it printed and out in the world in 2012.
You were looking always for people to be stewards of the land and the trails. How do people actually get involved in that?
Well, there are various ways. I'm involved, for instance, in a volunteer group with the El Dorado Community Improvement Association. They have a conservation committee, and they mobilize residents, trail users, equestrians, bikers, but also Boy Scouts. And I do a series of workshops with them and actually identify maybe trails that are, or areas for trails that are more appropriate maybe for equestrians in that area. And then we develop a trail based on this booklet, but then a little adapted that is better for equestrians.
What about the Girl Scouts?
Well, they should maybe participate too in another moment. So
Girl Scouts, take note. Okay,
yes, wonderful. Good idea. And then Charlie and I are involved in several other initiatives, and maybe, Charlie, you can talk about
those. Yeah, one of the others is the Trails Alliance of Santa Fe. It's an all-volunteer group that's been around for a couple of years now, and that actually started through an alliance between the Santa Fe Conservation Trust, the Santa Fe County, and the City of Santa Fe, and volunteers coming together to help work on Dale Ball Trail, La Tierra Trails, mostly trails in Santa Fe. They've expanded out into the National Forest. They've been working with another new group called the Santa Fe Fat Tire Society, which has been very active in helping to maintain and improve trails all around Santa Fe and beyond. And they've actually been quite remarkable in terms of the amount of enthusiasm they've brought to the whole stewardship of trails around Santa Fe. So both of those groups, Trails Alliance of Santa Fe, Santa Fe Fat Tire Society, both of those groups very active, have great websites and calendars up of events where people can get involved. Then also Commonwealth Conservancy that you might know about out in the Galisteo Basin. They actually are having an event this weekend for National Public Lands Day, they're going to be working on a couple miles of new trail out there that's open to the public. So there's quite a number of groups, as well as the Forest Service and others. So there's a lot of interest.
I think all of this highlights the importance of just getting outdoors. So there's a lot of trails in the Santa Fe area. There's trails within city limits. There's trails up mountains. There's one of the things I love is there's trails for that are great when it's really hot outside, and there's other places to go when it's quite cold outside. Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely. And I came here nearly 20 years ago, and what struck me first was the many trails, and also the historical trails that are here, old cow trails that go up in the mountains, like actually, for instance, the Atalaya Trail, but also trails along streams like in Deer Creek, and of course the old Santa Fe Trail, the Camino Real Trail. And so I really got a sense of Santa Fe as a trail hub, and I've only since then seen it grow and grow, and through my work I felt that trails were such a wonderful opportunity for people to connect to the outdoors, to learn how to take care of it and why it's important to take care of it, to take care of the forest landscape, the wildlife, but also the hydrology of the space, because a lot of trails are directly related to issues of erosion or erosion control.
There's also an issue of just simply getting outside is good for you.
Mm-hmm.
And were you saying, Charlie, you were telling me another time that there are people who are actually doctors writing prescriptions saying walk on the trails?
That's right. There's a national program called the Prescription Trails Program. I think that's the official name. But it involves doctors talking with their patients and prescribing local routes for people to walk and to have as part of their daily routine and part of their health plan. And I think in Santa Fe it's amazing all the different trails that we have, all the different opportunities we have for walking and getting out and seeing part of the history, and the health benefits are amazing. I mean, if we think about the obesity rate in this country, which is over 50% in most states and higher, I think, in New Mexico, we need to get out and be under our own power more and enjoy the benefits of that. And I think that, certainly at the Trust, one of our most exciting programs that's exciting for me is our Trails program, because it does allow us to really interact with folks and get out and what I like to call being a part of a new land ethic. And as Jan Willem is describing, getting people outside and having them connect with nature in whatever way that means for them, but a real opportunity to make that connection with the natural world that requires we being outside and be a part
That's
of it.
That's right. We had not too long ago an author named David Ryan who was on the program, and he wrote a lovely book called The Gentle Art of Wandering, and it was just about how to be aware when you're outdoors, whether it's in a city or whether it's on a trail or whatever. And you see so much more when you cultivate that kind of awareness, and our trails are such a great opportunity for that.
Yeah, and I think besides physical health, trails are a wonderful opportunity to maintain or renew your mental health. The fast-paced life that we have these days is very nicely compensated, I think, by going out and finding yourself back in that solitude or maybe in a small social group outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have talked with you and with lots of people on this show over the years about wildlife conservation and wildlife connectivity, and it turns out that so many animals migrate that it's really important to have not only areas for wildlife but areas that connect to each other so that they can migrate and not just hit pavement and places where they're going to die along the way. And I wondered if trails play a role in wildlife connectivity.
They play some role, and I can think in two different directions here. Trails are often in the transition zone or the edges of the landscape, because an interesting trail is not in a homogeneous landscape. It's often where you are on an edge. That's also where people feel most comfortable, where they feel safe, and where you have interesting views and experiences on a trail, and you'll just see it, that between wet and dry, between flat and steep, that's where you find the trails. That's also where people want to build their homes. That's in the larger landscape where cities or villages are built, because they have multiple opportunities in the ecology of the terrain to then find different resources initially when a village or town is built. And that's also where wildlife hangs out, because they have that, they need that variety, and they need the cover in the landscape on a small scale. But then if you start looking at the spine of the continent that was recently discussed here on your program with Mary Ellen Halibal.
Yeah, author of that wonderful book.
Yes, and so there is a continental divide trail, and there are many other long-distance trails where we are seeking collaboration between those groups of trails people to also think about the connectivity or to work together about large landscape connectivity for multiple users, not only for wildlife. Because if people become aware that just for recreation purposes, for connecting the areas of interest and the valuable landscapes for all kind of ecosystem services, as you may call them, across larger landscapes, then actually implicitly will take care of wildlife as well. And when it's unpleasant and you feel constrained because of highways or whatever for outdoor recreation, then it's definitely the case for wildlife as well. So if we can find common ground by connecting open spaces for multiple functions, then gradually for wildlife we may reach similar goals.
The Mountain Bike Conference is coming up October 10th through 13th, and the website for the International Mountain Bicycling Association is imba.com. The Trail Conference, organized by the Santa Fe Conservation Trust, is coming up October 10th, sfct.org. Now, what are you going to do with this? It's at the Community Convention Center on the day of October 10th. What are you going to be doing?
That's right. It's an all-day event. We're starting at 8:30 and going to go up to about 4 o'clock. We're going to be talking about all things trails. We're going to talk about the economic benefits of trails. We're going to talk about the health benefits of trails. We're going to be sharing success stories. We're going to take a large part of the morning and talk about those communities that have made a real commitment to grow their trails program and talk about what were the benefits of that. We're going to have folks up from Gallup, and they have a high desert trail system down there that's been just a huge success for them, a pretty complicated project, but has really been a great way to turn their economy around and add to it. So we're going to hear from them. And we're going to talk about some legal issues. We're going to talk about access and easements for folks if they're interested in donating land for trails to help expand trail systems. What does it mean for them? What does it mean if there's a trail that people have been using for 10 or 20 years and all of a sudden it's closed off? What's happened there? We actually have an example up in Glorieta of that exact situation. So we're going to talk about some real-world examples as well. And just really share stories. We're going to provide a forum for folks to come out and talk about how to grow trail programs in their communities.
And in addition to all of that, the Trails Alliance of Santa Fe is also on the web at trailsallianceofsantafe.org. Charlie O'Leary is Executive Director of the Santa Fe Conservation Trust. Jan Willem Janssens is an ecological planner and head of Ecotone. And anything else you guys want to let us know before we go?
Well, I'd like to mention that people can order the booklet Caring for Good Trails at the Santa Fe Conservation Trust website.
Excellent.
It's only $5, and it's a very handy 40-page small pocket guide.
Okay.
So,
yeah,
to you, Charlie.
And we'll have those available on October 10th as well at the Trails Conference. I just want to encourage as many people to come out as you can. We're asking that folks register in advance, so log on to our website. That's sfct.org. We're asking for a $5 donation at the door for coffee and treats, but
nice.
Come
so it's
by
a
and
virtually
share
the free day. Conference.
It's virtually free, yes.
And this book, Caring for Good Trails, is it something that just your average person who happens to go out hiking could make use of?
I think so. So because it would be great if people gradually have a sense of how with very simple, repeated techniques, they can actually make the trail drain. And I see just actually quite a few people understand that when they're walking through a soppy trail, that by poking a hole in a berm, my son would love to do that, for instance, that actually they can make...
Your nine-year-old.
That's right. They can make the trail drain, and then with that, you maintain the lifespan of that trail actually over time.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for being here. Very important and valuable information. Thanks for being on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mayor Charlotte.
And I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Ed Rosenblum. He is the director of the Santa Fe Backgammon Club. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So backgammon, who knew? I mean, I learn new things every day, but backgammon is a game that's 5,000 years old?
That's correct. It was found in Mesopotamia. There's old backgammon boards that existed in that time. And even 1,500 years later, at King Tut's tomb, they found backgammon boards. So he seemed to be a big player.
Are they the same as the ones that we use today?
They're different, different number of checkers or stones and different number of points. But the game was played basically the same way.
So what? Tell us about... Okay, so that's the history. It goes back 5,000 years. It's a game of two people playing against each other on this board, which is kind of complicated in that it's made up of these long triangles and you have to go in a kind of U-shape, and the two players are going in opposite U-shapes. But what do we know about it as it developed up to the game we play today?
Well, no one knows where the board originally came from and the design originally came from. But the game has evolved tremendously. It was very popular in the 20s and also in the 70s, and it was played without the aid of computers. So people would guess at what the best moves were. And the better players normally prevailed because they would learn over time what were the better plays. Today, and particularly in the last 20 years, we have the computer to help us determine exactly what the best moves are. So the game is going through a major transition right now where players can actually, they take pictures with their little iPhones and then they put them onto the computer and say, okay, what did I do wrong? And you learn constantly about the game.
But doesn't that take the fun out of it? I mean, shouldn't you be able to keep that in your head?
Not at all. There's 74 billion positions in a single game. So there's no way you can learn them all. So every game is different. Every game is a different challenge. It's sort of like multiple Rubik's Cubes are all at once, playing the position, looking at your timing, deciding whether you should hit an opponent's blot, which is a single piece, or make a point, or position your checkers in a certain way to restrict his movement, called a prime. It is a tremendous learning experience. At our club, I've watched the players come in from beginner to move into an intermediate, and some of them moving even to an advanced stage over time.
Now, I think I know how you're going to answer this, but is backgammon a game of more of chance or of skill?
The answer is basically yes. The game has both, and that's what makes it so exciting. An expert player will prevail over a period of time. So we play our games, we play matches. So the matches may be 5, 7, 9 points, which gives the luck element a chance to dissipate. What happens is that, you know, in a single game, the really good player can be outdone by just a lot of luck on the less good player. But over time, and I go to a lot of tournaments, and over time, the best players always prevail.
How long have you been playing?
40 years.
Really?
Yes.
And consistently?
Strongly at the beginning, in the 70s, then a little hiatus for a number of years, and then in the last 3.5-4 years, very heavy playing. Because of the transition of the game from trying to figure out what was right to knowing what is right and being able to justify a move and say, oh, this is absolutely right or this is absolutely wrong.
Are there different kinds of players? I mean, in chess, for example, there are some players who are super aggressive, and there's a whole range of almost personalities. Is that the same in backgammon?
Yes, it is, but style evolves. A novice player will be very tentative. They'll be very scared to make moves where they might get hit. They'll always be racing. A more experienced player knows when it's the proper time to hit, and it can be a lot more aggressive. So what I see more is it depends on your level of play, more determines your style of play.
Is there a psych-out element in the kind of psychological relationship with your opponent?
There can be. If you know your opponent, we play with a thing called a doubling cube, which is a whole fascinating piece of itself. And
what's that?
Well, it's a cube that has the numbers 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, and 64 on it. And a game starts off at 1 point. But at any point in the game, someone can pick up the cube, the player can, and say, I want to play for twice as much. And they turn the cube. And the opponent can say, well, I either accept that and we play for twice as much, or they drop it and the game is over and they move on to the next game. And once you have the cube, if you accept it, you have the cube at two, and then you own it, you possess it, and you only the player who owns the cube can turn it again to four should the game turn around. So what makes the game exciting, and getting back to your question, can you psych someone out, is you get in a position that you can double them and you expect them to drop it, so you get your point very easily.
Ah. You are the director of the Santa Fe Backgammon Club. What's that all about? You meet on Wednesdays.
We meet on Wednesdays at the Flying Star Cafe at 6 o'clock. Little plug. And the goal of the club is to learn backgammon. We have beginners, we have intermediates, and we have advanced players. I teach, and I have regular classes at the club. I have also classes that I run, group classes and individual lessons. So that's wonderful. We have a special backgammon board for teaching. I present problems to the class, and they're always around. And we have a wonderful group of people that play and enjoy themselves. And it's really just fun. And for the audience, don't be intimidated. It really is fun.
So you just show up at 6 o'clock at the Flying Star in Santa Fe.
Yes.
And you get to play backgammon all evening.
That's right. And if you're a novice, you play for free.
Ah. So the Flying Star must be delighted to have you there on Wednesday nights.
Yes, they are. They're delighted to have our group there. And we generally have anywhere between 12 and 16 players in the summer, and about 16 to 20 during the fall. But there's also a Scrabble group that meets there on Wednesday nights, as well as a chess group that meets there Wednesday nights. So it's sort of game nights.
Do you all know each other?
We know some of us know each other. We walk over and watch the chess guys, and they come over and watch us, and the Scrabble people, the same thing.
Do any of them defect to it, like, oh, the Scrabble player, we just lost a Scrabble player to backgammon?
No, everyone stays committed with their own group.
Now, do you have in backgammon national tournaments, things like that?
Yes, there is the American Backgammon Tour, or ABT for short.
Do you play?
Oh, I play a lot, yes. We go around the country and we play in tournaments. In fact, four members from the Santa Fe Backgammon Club are going to the Las Vegas tournament this November, which is a very big tournament. And there'll be about 140 to 160 players from all over the world playing in Las Vegas. And it's very exciting. And this is a five-day tournament in Las Vegas, one of the biggest ones. Most tournaments are 3 days.
Now, you have a website that people can also look at.
Yes, and it's www.santafebg.com.
SantaFeBG.com. Ed Rosenblum is the director of the Santa Fe Backgammon Club. And do you have all ages and all different kinds of people playing?
All ages, everywhere from kids that are 10 or 11 years old. They love the game. They love the probability and statistics about the game, to people that are well into retirement. And we enjoy every type of person.
Ed Rosenblum, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.